Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner. This is Sunday, March 27th. I always screw that up. It is Sunday, March 27th, 2011. And this is the 200th episode of the new revised Curmudgeon's Corner. Yay!
Let me ask you a question. Did the old one reach 200?
Oh, I don't think it got anywhere close.
No, right. I
don't really know without like finding the box in my storage space. The old one being, of course, the one Yvonne and I did in college, back in the early 90s.
Maybe not you and me. No, I actually,
you did it part of the time, and I did it some. I also co-hosted with Rebecca for a little while, our friend Rebecca, and right. I did a bunch of solo shows as well. And I don't think I had any other long-term co-hosts.
You didn't do the summer for the most part.
I did not do the summers. Yeah.
So that took to take away a number of shows.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that it did last more. Well, you did it through, because even after we graduated, you still stayed doing it
I think I did it 3 years. Because I did to recap our history in the wonderful WRCT, the college radio station of Carnegie Mellon, which you can listen to online if you are interested. I was not involved at all my freshman year. My sophomore year, I did news on the station, but only news.
Right, we did news. That's right.
I think my junior year is when we launched Curmudgeon's Corner, and that was you and me doing that. And then our senior year, we expanded the public affairs department to not just one show, there was a 5 to 6 o'clock show, I think, 5 or 7 days a week.
I think it was seven.
Anyway, Curmudgeon's Corner was, of course, one of those. And then I continued after my senior year as a sort of participant, but it was odd. Rebecca took over the public affairs department. She and I sort of had a disagreement on certain things were operating. So I stopped doing the show for a while, and then later, after she was gone, I did a few more shows. I don't know, but it was only school years, so it wouldn't be 50 weeks a year. It would be more right. like 25 right. or 30. If that, and we also didn't do it during like holidays and stuff where everyone went home. I think we probably no way we could have gotten much over 100. I mean, we probably did 100, but this show has gone on much longer and honestly has probably had much more, in terms of listenership than the original show. I mean, the original show, love WRCT, but it's the amount of reach it has wasn't that huge. I mean, it did cover most of the city of Pittsburgh, which is a pretty decent city.
City, hundreds of thousands of people,
but for the most part, people weren't listening.
Your guess is as good as mine as to how many people were actually listening.
And we did get callers. I mean, one advantage of that show over this is we did it live, so we had callers.
And so
there were a number of people on campus that were listening. Probably most of them were at the station or involved in the station in some way, but there were others that. And we got the occasional, call from other people involved in the university.
I got the occasional call from people trying to tell me that I knew nothing about nothing because I hadn't read anything or something.
I remember somebody asking me like where I'd gotten something from, and I named a random book that had absolutely nothing to do with the topic at hand. And he's like, "No, you're stupid," whatever,
There was another episode in which, for some reason, I think I went berserk. You almost wanted to die because I think I kept playing the 2001 theme song over and over.
Oh, good times.
For an entire hour. You know, but, well, actually, what happened was, for some reason, the show after hours didn't happen for some reason, so we wound up rolling it to 2 hours. So in the second hour, Sam was trying to do a serious show, and I just decided to screw around for a whole hour on the air, and a good portion of that was me dedicated to me replaying over and over the 2001 theme song, which drove Sam insane.
Yes, you know, yeah, well, like, you know, and there were all kinds of other, you know, interesting and fun things, you know, that happened at the station outside of our show as well. But just one thing for anybody out there who is still of an age where it's a possibility, you know, college radio is fun. You know, at least it depends on the college. Like, some college radio stations are really, like, you know, training you how to actually be involved in radio, and, like, are
right, and they're very rigid, and
it's like really your local, you know, public radio station, and it just happens that they let college students do some of the grunt work. No.
Right.
With real college radio stations, it's like completely operated by the students. They decide what the hell to do. They decide how to do it. And it's just a lot of fun. I mean, I suppose this is true of student activities in general. And, like, this is just the one that we happen to get into. But, this was a formative part of my college experience, was dealing with the radio station and doing things there. And it was a blast. And you know, we did a show like this, but, you know, we would veer off into random things. And, you know, there were all kinds of crazy stuff went on. And, you know, one advantage of another advantage of the radio show over what we do now is that we could actually call around and get guests without too much trouble. I mean, I haven't really tried that for this podcast, but come on. I can't remember. I don't think this was Curmudgeon's Corner proper, but on some of the shows we did, you know, we interviewed Mr. McFeely from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Yes, we did.
We interviewed, fringe candidates for vice president and president. You know,
we had that idiot. I think we had Rick Santorum.
Did we have Santorum? And see, he's a major national player now. You know, and we got invited to the. This was after you, unfortunately, Yvonne. But we got invited to the White House. We went and covered an event. Several of us ended up sitting like three rows into the room where, you know, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, various other members of the Clinton administration came to pitch their healthcare plan to talk show hosts. And we were sitting next to Jim Bohannon, who was a radio host of note. Rush Limbaugh was not there. However, I believe there were some others that you would remember now, but I don't remember. We got to do the show live from the South Lawn of the White House, and there, you know, we were sitting there doing our show, and, you know, a couple dozen feet over, you know, was Tom Brokaw doing the stand up for the NBC Nightly News. You know, and and we had Wolf Blitzer a few feet over doing CNN, and, you know, and we interacted with some of these people, and, you know, got to talk to them for a few minutes. And anyway, it's a great opportunity. I encourage anybody to take advantage of such opportunities. And, you know, it encouraged us years later. We're like, you know, we missed that crap. Let's do a podcast. And I remember I suggested it at one point, but then it took us like a year and a half before we actually did it. It involved, for instance, me upgrading my computer, because the one I had really wouldn't have been able to handle it. And, you know, but, and I didn't upgrade my computer because of this, but, like, we didn't start the show until that happened. And figuring out in general how we would do it. And, you know, it would have been nice if we'd started when I first suggested it. You know, we would have gotten a nice head start, but we started when we started, and, you know, we've had fun for like 3 years now, or almost 3 years, or wait, is it almost 4 years? Is it almost 4 years? Yeah. I looked this up last time.
It's almost 4 years.
Oh,
God. It's almost 4 years, yes.
You know, anyway, and you know, and we have not missed a week. Now, Yvonne's missed some weeks. I have not missed a single week. Now, I admit,
he has.
On the week that my son was born, I it was like a 2-minute show. And
right.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. I should have like talked for at least 15 minutes, but you know, I was doing it in the middle of the night and like I started talking and people started waking up and I'm like, oh shit, I better wrap it up. But anyway, but we've done something every week, have not missed a week. And, you know, I hope some of our listeners have been enjoying it. I know we've got at least one person who said they've listened to every single show ever since we started. Shout out to our listener, Matt. And we've had other people sort of listen for a while and then drop off and then listen again and then drop off. And we've had new people come in from various areas. And, and it's hard to tell from like download logs and stuff how many people are actually like listening and paying attention. But, you know, as of the end of last year, we were, you know, it was like 20 something people listening every week. And I think it seemed like it was growing. I'm still not caught up with stats, so we'll figure that out later. But the interesting stuff was, you know, they're people from all over the place who are just stumbling across it, who may only listen to a few minutes and then say, ah, this is crap, and tune out. But, you know, it's something. But, you know, at the same time, I have been surprised by, you know, hearing through the grapevine of people who've listened. You know, and it starts out potentially with people I know. Like, I found out, you know, for a while at least, my sister was listening to us on a regular basis. But then her boyfriend started listening. And he was listening for a while. I think he's an ex-boyfriend now, but, you know, whatever. Anyway, and you know, I met with somebody I went to high school with who was in town, and I had dinner with him a couple months ago, and he's like, oh, yeah, I listened to your show. So, and I'm like, oh, wow. You know, so thanks. Thank you to all of our listeners. Tell your friends.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, well, we've gone on about that for a while. You know, I'll also mention we are very subject light for this 200th show. Yvonne and I were talking before we started about what's going on in the world, and yes, there's a lot still going on in the Middle East. Yes, there's updates in Wisconsin and Japan and blah, blah, blah. But it's all stuff that we've talked about a lot in recent weeks. So we didn't really feel like we had all that much to add. We might talk about them a little bit, but we're very light on subject matter for this show. Anyway, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll try to talk about something else. And hopefully some stuff that's a little bit different from the international stuff we've been talking about the last few weeks. Although, you know, like I said, we'll probably mention it some. Anyway, we'll be back after this. Enjoy your break. And here we are. So, I wanted to give one quick update, and then we'll move on to other stuff. I mentioned a few shows ago how my iPhone's GPS was completely screwing up and not functioning properly and blah, 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 and how the genius at the Apple store told me to, you know, basically reset the phone and then start from scratch. I reset the phone and then restored from a backup, which is slightly different than what they said. I finally got around to it. For weeks and weeks, I've been like, oh my God, this takes forever. I don't have 3 hours to sit down and do this. But like one time last week, I was up late actually doing something for work. I ended up staying up really, really late to get it done. While I was doing it, I reset the phone. And surprise, surprise, it seems to have fixed it. It's a little early. It's a little early. It's only been like a couple days, but... and I have had a couple you know, weird GPS dropouts, but I think they're back to normal. And for the first time in weeks and weeks and weeks, I've been able to use, like, you know, navigation software on my phone and have it do something reasonable. You know,
wow.
And you know, like I said, there are occasional glitches here and there, but I think that's sort of the normal glitches here and there, as opposed to the, oh my God, this is completely screwed up. So I'm happy. And, you know, any negative aspersions I may have made to that particular Apple Genius, I take them all back. I'm sorry. Now, I think I think they diagnosed it in a weird way. Like, the thing that they told me was the clue that told them that it was messed up did not make sense. However, you know, it's back to the
solution was correct.
The solution was correct. It's back to the good old, you know, when in doubt, reformat the fucking thing and start over. And 99% of the time, it'll fix whatever the hell problem you have. It's one step more than reboot. First is when in doubt, reboot. But then once you've rebooted, you know, the next is, you know, do this kind of reset. And I finally got around to do it. I did it. And lo and behold, it seems to have actually fixed the problem. You know, if it goes flaky again, I'll let you guys know. But it looks pretty good. Yeah, so there's my update.
All right, cool. So anything else we got? I mean,
you want the one topic that you had was some stuff RIM is doing, Research in Motion, the folks who make BlackBerries.
Well, okay. Well, the thing is that a couple of months ago, RIM had to very early pre-announce this tablet that they were coming out with, the Playbook. Basically, their hand was forced. Oh, just like HP's hand was forced to pre-announce their Palm tablet, because basically, I mean, you know, they were so behind on releasing one that they needed people to know, hey, we're gonna have one out soon. So, you know, if you want to think about it before you buy that iPad, we're coming out with one. Yeah, really, really. So anyway, they did that a couple of months ago. And I guess RIM is about to come out with their Playbook pretty soon. But the one thing is that was interesting that this week, and some people called it some kind of a capitulation by RIM, is that they are allowing the Playbook to run Android apps.
What were they going to have on there? Their own, like...
Well, they were going to have their own OS with their own app store.
Right.
And all of a sudden, this week, RIM goes and says... you know, I'm like, they're, well, yeah, we've got an OS that you could build apps on, and, you know, we got it. But given that it just seems like nobody really wants to write any for our thing, well, you know, we'll just make it run Android apps too. So all of a sudden it becomes, well, why the fuck do we, what's the angle? I mean, you know. Yeah, I mean, I don't. Well, at least I'm talking from a corporate perspective. I mean, if that's what they were going to do, then might as well have built the freaking tablet from and run the Android OS from scratch. I mean, don't you think?
You know, look, the whole thing with this kind of stuff is, you know, yes, you can either if you don't want to do that kind of upfront investment, then starting with Android is the place is the choice you have right now, really. If you're not going to build your own OS, if you are going to build your own OS, you have, on one hand, it's great for interesting competition, you know,
right.
But you know, developers who are out there doing apps only have so much attention to give. And, you know, if you're third or fourth in the space, I mean, because at this point you've got of course iOS on the Apple products, right. You've got Android doing all kinds of other stuff, you've got, you know, the Windows Mobile 7 stuff, you've right. got the whatever they're calling the old Palm Pre stuff now,
WebOS.
Right. So you've got at least four of these out there, and if you're talking about introducing a fifth, I mean, already, you know, the Windows 7 and WebOS folks are going to have are having some trouble getting up to the same level of interest as iOS and Android, and Android is still behind iOS. It's a very, very steep road to walk. To try to
let me give you the numbers. How steep? Okay, there's 350,000 apps for iOS. Okay, 65,000 iPad specific. Okay, 350,000 total. Android has 150,000 apps right now out. Okay, total. So 350 to 150. The total number of apps that are on the BlackBerry app world is 10,000.
Right.
Now,
one thing to remind people of when they look at numbers like this is if you look at the 350,000 apps on iOS, most of them are crap. You know, there is a definite long tail effect where, you know, the top 1,000 apps or whatever, maybe not even 1,000, are the ones that lots and lots of people use and that are really good high quality. And then you've got, you know, your 50 different variants of fart apps, you know?
yes, you do.
You know, so there is an argument that could be made that 10,000 apps is enough if they're the right 10,000 apps. But I think, I think what that misses though, is that it's also about the ecosystem and it's about people experimenting and trying new things and, having an idea and bringing it to market. And so, you know, in order to have thriving innovation, you're going to have lots of crap, but every once in a while, somebody's going to make something new and innovative that people haven't really thought about before. And all of a sudden it's going to be, oh yeah, of course I need that, or I want that, or that's going to be fun.
But here's the other problem in this. Okay. The cut that Apple keeps, okay, and how they're making money and therefore funding even building more product, okay? You got a serious problem if you can't sell the apps.
Right.
I mean, because Apple keeps, I think, on every app, like, what, 20, 30%?
I think it's 30.
On the sale of every app? 30% on the sale of every app, okay? So, I mean, that's a huge revenue stream. If you can't have that, then you're going to get killed trying to sell freaking tablets at a competitive price, which obviously has been discovered at the fact that Motorola on the Zoom, you know, went and like launched it and they couldn't, in order to try to match the features, all of a sudden, price wise, they couldn't get there. And so you wind up in a little bit of a problem here if you can't have that revenue stream. In terms of doing that, so I don't know what we'll see, but I mean I think that the more tablets out there and the more competition, the better. I honestly feel like Research in Motion is almost like raising the white flag before the battle even started. I mean, let's face it, these things have only been for sale for less than a year.
But at the same time. You know, I've heard lots of comments made by, you know, people were really waiting to find out what was happening. What was it? Was it the, oh God, what, there was some tablet that came out right before the iPad 2, and lots of people were like, basically, hey, this is a really good tablet, really good specs, but I would not recommend, anybody who's not like, a techie writer type, to buy this right now. I would not recommend it to my grandfather or whatever. Wait to see what the iPad 2 looks like. And, and you'll probably want to get that instead, because there is so much momentum and so much, out there in terms of that. And everybody else is still like, even when they compete on specs, is still behind on experience, behind on apps. And, it's going to take for another company to really come up and start taking this market seriously away from Apple. You know, there are two directions to go. One is compete on price and try to make something that's not as good but is dirt cheap. And so everybody who can't afford an iPad is like, oh well, but maybe this.
Right.
The other is to really come up with something new and innovative that is not being done or handled well by the iPad. Because otherwise, if they're not one of those two directions, then they're constantly going to look like an imitator. Like, you're just trying to be like the iPad.
That's what everybody's doing right now.
They're just imitating right now.
They're just, everybody seems to be just catching up, just to imitate this damn thing.
Well, I've heard the estimate that, you know, all of these other tablet makers are at least a year behind Apple in terms of figuring out what the hell to really do with these tablets. And again, it's like, you know, maybe you can make a decent tablet experience with Android. I mean, you know, Android on the phone side of things, you know, it is competitive. It does some interesting things. There's some groups of people who really, really love their Android phones and think iPhones are crap. And for the kinds of things they're doing, maybe that's right. And there's also carrier effects there. But, you know, no one's going to dispute that an Android phone isn't a decent phone that has some interesting things to do with it. It is certainly possible that, you know, Android could do the same thing with tablets. They just haven't yet. You know, the Android is still most of the tablets that are operating on Android are based off the phone based Android without things really optimized for the tablet. I believe the one that came out right before the iPad was a Android based tablet that was actually, you know, designed to be a tablet from the beginning, from the OS on up. But there's still a lot of things to work out there, and it's just, you know, if you pick a random person off the street and you ask them about this kind of stuff, they're thinking iPad. They're not thinking whatever all these other companies are coming out with. And, you know, and that's and again, you know, going back to, you know, doing the new innovative thing instead of imitating, you know, the other companies just haven't been good at that. I mean, witness the iPad itself, you know?
Right.
There were tons of tablets before the iPad. Aside from very limited markets like healthcare and some other things, no one liked them, you know?
I had one, and it sucked ass,
you know? Okay? And because they were trying to put desktop operating systems on a tablet. And Apple was like, yeah, that's bullshit. Let's make a big iPhone. You know,
yeah.
Although I've heard some rumblings that from a prototype point of view, they were working on the tablet before they were working on the phone, and it might have even been the reverse, where they were like, you know, the world's not ready for this tablet. Let's start with a phone. You know, but I don't know what the truth of that is. But you know, it boom, you have something completely brand new, and you know, I've seen quotes online from people. Talking about how, you know, we're getting repetitive again, you know, people who are buying these instead of buying laptops, and people who perceive that the tablet does more. The one quote, I think it was linked from Daring Fireball, but it was a blog of some, like 14-year-old developer. So it was a teenager, and talking about their friends and what they were talking about, and, you know, overhearing a conversation about people thinking about getting a laptop and, you know, being suggested an iPad instead because, quote unquote, it does more. Now, I'm not sure on any objective standard you could actually say it does more, but it does it in a way that is much more.
Well, you could argue that, because the one thing is that, let's face it, as a, you know, for example, you can use an iPad, say, to watch video while you're exercising, for example, for which a laptop you can't use for that. You can use the tablet. It would be extremely awkward. Yes, okay, you can use it. You know, you could carry it around.
Well,
I've seen a lot of people have a laptop, and you can carry it around as an appliance, as a check-in device.
And this is the thing that people are still talking. You know, the people who don't get it are still talking about it in terms of, well, of course a laptop can play video, but that's not the point. The point is not that it can play video. The point that is it can play video easily in a way that you can carry it around and put it here, and its mobility makes a difference. And the way you interact with it makes a difference. The fact that you can go to an app store and click a couple buttons and get a new app instead of having to do some convoluted installation process makes a huge fucking difference. You know, and
that's right.
You know, of course, you know, your general purpose computer that's sitting on your desk, let alone your laptop, can do anything. Computers can do anything. They're general purpose devices. That's the whole point of them. However, packaging it in such a way that makes it easy and simple and blah, you know, like, you know, let's face it, for the majority of users, their computers are Facebook, the web, other websites maybe, and email maybe, and some instant messaging if they don't do all of, that some people do all of the above on Facebook, but yeah, there's a very limited set of things that most people actually use their computers for. You know, photos, music, Facebook, you know, email, you know, and all of these devices do all of that well, but, you know, you make it easy, it makes a difference. I guess that's the point. And that goes for, you know, that goes for computers as well. But the whole notion of the tablet is, you know, for a lot of people, if that's all they really need, then the tablet's all they need.
Right.
So anyway,
I agree. Anyway.
Okay. Let's take a break. We've beat that one to death, and we've been repetitive because we've said all this before. So let's take a break. It's time for your poem of the week. We'll be back after this with some other stuff.
This is the Curmudgeon's Corner Poem of the Week, brought to you by Notel Motel.
Destruction of the Bower of Bliss by Kate Shapira. Infrequent, unfragrant sighs scathe and raise the fresh air, cozy up to the interfering bank. Cue the old lady choir, sisterhood of teamsters, double-headed horses, pulling the flesh self against itself where impatience breeds and lives. Down it already, like larva in a bucket of gentle confidence in the future. Fear strikes into my heart case, like a tall stair, that old bitter twist. Keep it, keep it. Wheezing old lady underside, taking the green boughs down the welcome mat.
For more like this, go to notelmotel.org with a new poet each week and a new poem every weekday.
Okay, here we are. Do do do. Hey, you know, I thought of one other topic while we were chatting about and so let me throw this out there, and I'm going to try to keep it in generic terms because this is also something we've talked about before. But there were recent articles about somebody named Amanda Hocking. Have you heard of Amanda Hocking?
No. Who's the...
So look up Amanda Hocking. Basically, she is an author who decided, yeah, she was doing other stuff. She started writing stuff. She threw a few things up as ebooks.
H-O-C-K-I-N-G.
Yes. Okay. Right. Anyway, she started to throw a few things up on ebooks. No publisher, no whatever. Essentially, she's doing self-publishing. And somehow, and I don't understand exactly how, readers found her, started reading her shit, started buying her books, and she's been raking in a shitload of cash. Pardon my French.
Okay.
And the point is, she is making more money than lots of traditional authors do through publishing houses, because of the cut that the ebook bookstores give her. This is part of the, you know, and apparently she just signed with a major publisher too, because somebody offered her like a $2 million advance, you know, and like people were criticizing her and saying like, well, why don't you keep with what you're doing? It seems to be working. And she's like, $2 million advance?
Yeah, yeah. But it's like they don't understand. I mean, when you get a publishing house behind you, so you get marketing, advertising, yes, people that, to help you with this, and, people to be with that. I mean, Jesus, you know, it's like, yeah, I mean, you're doing all this shit by yourself.
Lets you concentrate on the writing and not deal with all the other stuff. If you're a writer, that's what you care about and that's what you want to be spending your time on. But anyway, the point here is that it is now, you know, self-publishing in any form whatsoever has traditionally been mocked in various ways. The world is changing, you know, and there are ways that, and there are apparently a few, you know, authors who've made a lot of money in the past through traditional publishing houses who are putting out some of their new projects this way. You know, both for the print on demand stuff and the e-publishing stuff, because if you cut out the middlemen, and if you somehow are able to do the marketing and have people find your content, your cut is a lot bigger if you don't go through these intermediaries. And the same is true of music. You have musicians starting to do this as well. I think it's only a matter of time till you really start seeing this happening in video entertainment as well. You know, most of the projects you've seen there, I mean, you have had like Dr. Horrible and stuff like that, which did pretty well, but there still haven't been that many of them. You know, I think this is a real trend, and, you know, the whole industries are going to be shaken by the fact that this kind of thing is now possible. And yes, you still need editors. You still need marketers, potentially, in order to get a really good success. But do you really need the one big intermediary, you know, publishing firm that's going to take, you know, a huge cut of the profits and do all of this? No, probably not. You probably need, you know, small, lightweight units that'll do those kinds of things, you know, for, you know, sort of the author hires them to do specific activities, like they hire an editor to edit their book for a fixed price or whatever, as opposed to a percentage, you know, things like that. You're going to see interesting models coming up and changing, and I don't know. I think all that's very exciting. It makes me feel like that if I had any ability or time whatsoever to write something, I should write something, but I don't.
Well, so since we don't, you know, that's a moot point. Okay.
Maybe I can come out with a hit song instead.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, why don't we try right now?
You know, the little break I have about, like, the something about an elephant? You know, I think that's going to be a hit. I'm going to put it up on iTunes for sale.
There you go. I think that's a brilliant idea.
Yeah, I mean, and what have we been thinking giving away this podcast for free? We should charge a buck a show.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah, charge them. Yeah, exactly, of course. Yeah, I'm sure that, you know. Oh, yeah. The dollars are going to be pouring in. Absolutely.
Absolutely. We'll you know, we'll be rivaling Bill Gates before we know it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually gonna take a cue from the New York Times pricing plan to start our method of charging.
Oh, you're right. Forget a dollar, yes, a show. For Curmudgeon's Corner, $500 a year.
A year. That's right. And I'm going to charge you, exactly, I'm going to start a pricing structure. I'm going to charge you extra if you try to listen to it on your iPod or on your iPhone or on your computer. So there'll be different, there'll be a multi-tiered structure depending on where you listen to it, of course.
But,
absolutely.
But yes, we will give it to you free if you buy the print edition.
That's right. If you get a transcript of our show, we will give you the ability to listen to it for free. Yes.
Okay. Anyway.
Okay. Anyway. All right. Okay. Back to reality. All right.
Back to reality. Oh, and I should mention our friend Rebecca does a lot in the self-publishing realm as well, and could probably tell us lots about it. We should, yeah. But RebLivingston.net, I think it is. I don't know. Hey.
Or is it?
I don't know. Okay. Wait. Let's get it right for her publishing.
Well, for God's sakes, I mean, we're going to screw her up. Okay, yes. Yes, reblivingston.net. Yes, I got to her, you know, thing.
You know, she's, anyway, does all kinds of things. There's No-Tell Books, which is a press that she does, and No-Tell Motel, which is where we get our poems of the week. So all kinds of interesting stuff there. Anyway, moving on. Next.
Moving on. Next. What's next? Well, Libya's in flames. Japan is radioactive. Syria is fighting. And okay, that's it.
I will say on Libya, Obama's going to give a speech sometime between when we record this and when I put it out. But you know, it's going okay so far. You know, we did stop the advance of Gaddafi's folks to, you know, wipe out the rebels. In fact, it's gone the other direction.
It's the other direction. Gaddafi is having to retreat significantly.
Yes, yes. I mean, so that's happening. I mean, you know, and I don't think, you know, we expressed all kinds of doubts the last few weeks. I don't think that, just to be clear, the doubt is not necessarily along the lines of, if the combined militaries of NATO really put their mind to it, could we get rid of Gaddafi? It's more a matter of they could. They absolutely could.
Oh, we've got no doubt about that. I mean, we've shown our great ability to blow the bejesus out of anybody if we put our mind to it.
The question is more about, is this really a wise intervention, both in terms of the unforeseen consequences that always come out of interventions like this, and also the possibilities for us to get sucked into something long term. I think those are the questions, and it's going to take a long time for that to play out and see what's really happening here. I've definitely seen some arguments made that by our intervention here, we're sort of, making a statement that will influence other regimes that are currently having issues, and I don't know. We'll see how it all plays out. It's going to take months for us to really know, even short term, what's going on, and we won't get true good historical perspective for years. So, but so far, so good, I guess. You know, we're getting the results along the lines that were anticipated by the resolution.
We'll see what happens. Listen. I was all for averting a bloodbath. I said this before. I was worried about that. I must be honest. But, the one thing that I was concerned is that every time recently in the last, decade, it just seems like, I didn't want to go into another one of these things where we just go in by ourselves and just, there's a lot of other parties, that can be involved and should be involved that could help as well.
It's not just the going in by ourselves thing to me, like if it was a really good cause and we had the resources and we were the only ones able to do it, I don't mind necessarily going in unilaterally, if a number of other conditions are true. But the thing that happens in a lot of these cases, let's look at the prototypical examples here of both Iraq and Afghanistan. In both those conflicts, if you looked at what was going on in the first 6 months, maybe even a year, it all looked really positive. We rolled right over. We took over. We installed our people. In many cases, there really were, like in Iraq, people going, "Thank you, America, for coming in." It seemed to be going very positively at first, and then things start to turn south.
And then,
reality
sets in.
And then reality sets in. You realize that it's a long slog and it's complicated. You get, insurrection type forces organized and starting to make an impact, because when you're first coming in, like everybody, it's like shell shock. Oh my God, the Americans just came in. But then after a few months, a year, there's like, oh, okay, well, the Americans are here. Now what happens? And you enter a different phase. These things have the very much the potential of, even when they start out looking beautiful, going south, and then I could see us in, not even in 2012, in 2016, in the next set of presidential elections, us talking about what we're doing in Libya.
Lord.
You know, we've, you know, how long have we been in Afghanistan now? How long have we been in Iraq now? With really no end in sight in either. I mean, theoretically, we've removed combat troops from Iraq, but we've still got like 50, 60,000 people there, you know, doing whatever. And, you know, supposedly one of, you know, the drawdown in Afghanistan was supposed to be starting around now. It doesn't look like there's much really going to happen there. You know, we have shown a tendency that once we get involved somewhere, it's very, very difficult for us to get back out. I mean, it practically, honestly, one way to look at this is since World War II, the only country that we've been in a war in that we have actually ever completely gotten out of was Vietnam.
Yep.
And that's because we got our asses kicked.
Yeah, I mean, we still got troops in Germany, in Japan,
Korea.
I mean, think about this. I mean, it's been 60 years, 70 years close
to it. I apologize. I don't actually know what the status is of American forces in Grenada right now.
I believe that there are no forces in Grenada.
Oh, okay, so we got out of Grenada, too.
Yes.
Huzzah.
Yes, we did leave Grenada. Okay, yes. Basically, probably because there was really no room for us to stay on the tiny little island anyway.
Yeah.
You know, I think we sent in more soldiers than there were population to the island.
Okay, so that's Libya and the Middle East. As Yvonne mentioned at the beginning, all kinds of other places are blowing up. Syria has seen a lot of action in the last week. Yeah, there's still things going on in Bahrain. There's, you know, all kinds of... There's still lots of action and momentum and bubbling going on here, and I think you're going to continue to hear about it for months to come. Okay, so that's the Middle East. Let's see, Wisconsin? Anything?
I don't know about what's going on in Wisconsin anymore.
Yeah.
Wait. There was, I think there was a judge that put an injunction against...
There was a judge that put on an injunction, and then the Secretary of State enrolled the law anyway. There was a judicial injunction to keep the law from going into effect, but then apparently they published the law anyway, which nominally should put it into effect. And so there's a big question of what's actually going on right now. I keep dropping things. Let's see, that's Wisconsin.
Let's see.
It's springtime, at least here. It's warmer.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, my allergies started acting up, so yes, it must be spring.
There was a super moon.
Yeah, we had the super moon. Yeah. That was a week ago.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we probably even talked about it. I don't
know. Yeah, we probably did.
I think we're done. Unless there's something exciting that you want to finish up, we'll do three segments this week instead of four and wrap it up.
One thing that I do remember about... I'll make one thing that I remembered about our old show when we did it on the radio. You know, one thing about it is that we were not supposed to say curse words over broadcast radio because it could bring a problem, okay?
And we have had complaints on this show.
As you guys may know... I was the guy on the show, so basically that had problems. Obviously,
we did have a delay, and we had a producer with their hand on the beep button.
Yes, but frequently, like some of the we didn't at first. We didn't have the beeping button. Remember how you had to try to when we were doing the show for
there's a cord from the production.
You had to pull a cord from the wall to try to do that.
Yeah, there was a delay, and there was a delay box that introduced a delay, and then out of the box it went actually onto the air. So if there was something that was said that was wrong, the mechanism we used at first, and maybe to the end, I don't remember, was you actually pulled the cord out that connected the delay box to actually going out on the air. And so you would just get silence, but you had to sort of, you had that 10 seconds to get to that cord and pull it out of the thing.
Yeah. Right. And Sam, you know, kept having to do that all the time on me, you know, because I obviously, you know, had problems.
And like I said, we have had complaints on this show about our language. At least two people, and maybe even more, but at least two people have said, do you guys really have to swear? And we've sort of said...
And apparently the answer has been yes, because honestly, apparently I know no other form of communication, according to practically everybody that knows me. So anyway, you know.
You could do that rapid bilingual thing and do all your swearing in Spanish.
I could do that. That would be an option. I do. The other day, we went about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago to a lunch, and my boss said, hey, there's going to be this person there. Don't swear that much. Think how well that worked. Then we had the head of U.S. corporate HR in the office, and actually we came up that the best solution was for me not to work from the office that day.
Good job. Good job, Yvonne.
So I went, what? And he said, well, why don't you close your door? And I'm like, yeah, like that's going to really deaden the sound. How about if I just go, I'm going to go work from somewhere else. Okay.
Excellent.
So anyway. All
right. Well, one more note on swearing. Did you see the King's Speech movie?
No, I have not. No, I have not.
So, very good movie.
But did the king used to swear a lot?
There was one scene. So, anybody who doesn't know the premise, this is a true story. In World War II, the king had a speech impediment. Basically, he, whenever he was put under pressure in a real situation, he would stutter a lot. And so, he needed to give some speeches related to World War II, where it was important that he sounded like a kingly leader and blah, 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 and stuttering his way through it just wasn't going to do it. So he was seeing a speech therapist, essentially. And one of the scenes, basically, is the speech therapist gets him mad and gets him swearing. And you get about 2 minutes of him, like, swearing a complete blue streak, you know, all the curse words you could possibly think thrown together into a two-minute period. Now, it's a very good, very powerful scene. Now, here's the interesting part of this. After the show was in the theaters, the movie was in the theaters for a few months, the company that put it out, and I'm not going to get the details right because I read the article a few weeks ago, the company that put the movie out silently started replacing the version in the theaters with one of the cuts that you usually see on airplanes and stuff, with all the curse words replaced by less innocuous words. So that they could show it for a while with a PG-13 rating instead of an R rating and squeeze a few more dollars out of it at the box office. But it wasn't, you know, yeah, it's so like if you went to go see the King's Speech later on in its release cycle, you could go in and instead of the scene that was like very powerful and made sense with this guy swearing, and you'd hear like nonsense. And that...
Interesting.
You know, this is the kind of... Anyway, you know, people get all worked up about swearing and, you know, nudity and all this other kind of stuff. It's like, you know, just leave it the fuck alone. You know? If you've got, like... And I'm not necessarily talking about the gratuitous stuff where in the slasher movie, you know, the girl has to go into the shower before the monster just, you know, cuts her up into pieces. But, you know, in cases where this kind of stuff is like integral and makes sense in a story, you know, come on. You know?
Yep.
And of course, violence is allowed no matter what. But, you know, have a little swearing or a little nudity or these days somebody smoking, then, oh my God, you can't let kids see this. You know, anyway.
Anyway.
Okay, we're
right,
done.
Let's go. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for joining us for the 200th episode of the New Curmudgeon's Corner. Happy 200th. Yay. And as usual, tell your friends, have other people listen to us. If you enjoy us, tell other people you think might like it. And email me at abelsmay@abelsmay.com with any questions, comments, thoughts, you know, bribes, you know, whatever. And we'll talk to you later. Enjoy your week and goodbye.
Bye-bye.